Welcome back to another episode of The Political Life. Today, I have a feeling we're going to be talking about reconciliation again, some more, maybe some infrastructure, maybe a little bit about the process. To do that, I could talk about it, of course, because I am very knowledgeable about all those things, or I could actually have someone on the show who actually knows what he's talking about. And that's what I decided to do instead of faking it. And we have Rich Gold, prior guest. We love talking to Rich. Rich runs the very large firm, government relations firm of department at Holland & Knight, one of the premier lobbying firms in DC. And we love talking to Rich. We thought now that the Republicans, Mitch McConnell, came on board and allowed the easy route to raising the debt ceiling, that we would circle back with someone like Rich and hear about everything going on in DC. And so, Rich, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jim. Appreciate you having me.
Well, Rich, we love having you. And while we're recording this, he's taking a few days off, which he's really not taking a few days off. He's just in a different location. But I'm going to read the automatic reply that I got from Rich when I emailed him this morning. And it says, "Everybody needs a little time away from reconciliation this week. The dictionary, remember what that is, kids, defines reconciliation as the restoration of friendly relations." I did not know that. "We are nowhere near that right now, even among Democrats. So kick back, gain some perspective, and get ready to get these bills across the finish line. I'll be in and out this week," so forth and so on. So, Rich, I like that little automatic reply. Instead of the boring, "I'm out of office, good luck," you have a little bit of a message. So first, a little history. Were you surprised that the Republicans had to ultimately get on board and help with raising the debt ceiling?
No, because we've always gotten there. It's kind of interesting, as you may know, Jim, from previous interviews and the Rich Gold fan base is aware of, I have seen over 200 Grateful Dead shows. And the debt limit is very similar to going to a Grateful Dead show in the sense that you know generally the cadence of what's going to happen and how it's going to end. You just don't know how you're going to get there. And that's what makes Grateful Dead shows so wonderful. And I think what drives people crazy about the debt limit, right? It's like, I know we're not going to default. We never have. We're not going to now. But when people start talking about printing a $1 trillion platinum coin, you're like, oh, come on, right?
Like, we haven't seen this move before.
Look, I make a lot of stuff up, you know, it's sort of the nature, but I can't even make something like that up.
I think a lot of people thought originally that was a joke, and maybe it was a little bit. And the Republicans sure seem to try pretty hard to force the Democrats to do it alone. Ultimately, Senator McConnell decided that probably best just to help them get it done and move on to the next issue.
Well, I think only because it's short term. Like, I would never accuse Mitch McConnell of being, you know, sort of helpful to Democrats. He is very good at what he does, and that is not what he does. So he definitely has a motive for extending to December. And my guess is it was a combination of some of his conference getting concerned about getting that close to the third rail, as well as the fact that it's not a permanent extension and it's just going to resurface again after, you know, we kind of get through Thanksgiving.
Right. The Democrats did seem to be winning the public debate in the perception that, you know, the Republicans were needed to help make this happen. And you saw immediately after it was done, the Senator McConnell said, you know, Democrats now have 2 months. So if they want to raise it in December, they should start getting their ducks in a row. And I think that's what you're alluding to by the short term.
Yeah. I mean, I still don't think we have kind of the pathway to the permanent solution here, right? I mean, there are certainly, you know, Speaker Pelosi's is talking about sort of reversing the burden and allowing Treasury Secretary authority and thus Congress overrides to raise the debt limit. You know, the debt limit is really an anachronism at this point. This is one of those issues that, you know, if we were serious about governing, we would just sort of understand that this no longer serves a purpose. It's not like it's putting some cap on spending. In fact, obviously, Republicans added a couple trillion during the Trump administration to the national debt, more than a couple trillion. And that's why we are raising the debt limit right now. So we are raising it because of the spending that was done during the Trump administration, not because of the spending that is being proposed by the Biden administration. So both parties have been equally undisciplined in terms of reining in federal spending in this place. So why we have this artificial, you know, cliff that we set for ourselves every few years is a little bit, I think, beyond all of us who do this for a living. But it's a little bit like, you know, just having a meme for the end of Thelma and Louise, where you're just going to relive that moment where they drive off the cliff together over and over and over again and pretend as if something different is going to happen. Or pick your other analogy, 51st States or Groundhog Day or whatever. Like, you know, if our children did this in their daily lives, we would look at them and say, that is not how adults act, except, you know, this is how adults act.
Right. Well, I think your how you describe the process is a pretty accurate one. We know how it's going to end. We're just not sure what it's going to look like.
Gary guitar solo in here either, by the way.
So let's talk a little bit about the two big bills that are sitting out there.
You need to demonstrate encyclopedic knowledge of how to every route and every destination and to pass an exam that lays all that out. And it is one of these like arcane areas of study that, as it turns out, if you didn't grow up in London, it's almost impossible to pass this test, right? And yet, you know, obviously taking a formal cab in London is an experience, especially for an American tourist who's way too used to Uber now. So it's this area of expertise and knowledge that is relevant in a very narrow focus of life. And for everybody else on the planet, they look at that and go, well, that's kind of cool, but I'm never going to do that. To me, budget reconciliation is our version of the knowledge, right? And in fairness, like there are way fewer people who can pass the budget reconciliation test than there are people who can pass the knowledge in London. I will do the shout out for my, you know, my mentor and godlike character in this space, my brother from another mother, Marty Gold at Capital Council, who has been general counsel to 3 Senate majority leaders and is the smartest guy I know on this stuff. So I am not claiming knowledge like knowledge of budget reconciliation. I am just saying I know more than most people know in this space. And so here we are in the midst of reconciliation with elected officials proclaiming things like they want to do immigration reform and budget reconciliation, which, if it hasn't already fallen by the wayside, will very quickly, and other niceties that have no business fitting into reconciliation in terms of the definition of what will and won't fit under the Byrd rule in the Senate. And yet, as is wont to be the case, we will have, you know, members and senators fighting for things and putting forward things that will in no way, shape, or form make it into the package at the end of the day. I think where we started this week is we're at the end of the beginning on reconciliation. And that is the idea that you're going to throw crazy stuff on the table right now and say, I'm going to fight for this and I may not vote for it unless it's in, is over. We are now down to, there have been a number of things talked about for the budget reconciliation bill and Build Back Better, as it's being called, and boy, we need a better name. And we are going to start winnowing down those things, eliminating some of them, and scaling back others. And the real question here is, at the end of the day, is what's going to not only survive, but survive at close to its original level of funding if the package goes from 3.5 to, say, 1.5 or 2 trillion, which I think is probably where we're going to end up at the end of the day. You know, there's been a little bit of a debate this week on should we cut back the number of programs to only cover a handful of things really well, or should we keep the current broader scope of programs that range from drug pricing and healthcare to climate to affordable housing and provide lesser amounts of funding for that broader scope. And it seems to be the case, assuming Speaker Pelosi is reading her caucus the right way, that progressives would rather have that broader scope and lower funding levels, meaning, you know, we may not provide a benefit for the full 10 years of the budget agreement. Maybe you ramp it up and then scale it down, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, we'll wait to see sort of how that discussion goes over with the White House and the senators. The other thing that's becoming clear is Senator Manchin and Senator Sinema are not actually the same person, and they have different priorities. If you kind of looked at it from the perspective of a Venn diagram, the overlap between the two of them is not terribly large. And that's going to make squaring this circle a lot more difficult than otherwise be the case. So Senator Manchin doesn't like, for instance, the CEP program, which is the Clean Energy Payment Plan program that will both raise revenue and allow utilities to switch to solar and wind and other non-carbon-based energy sources, in part because of his coal base in West Virginia, but in part because he, you know, philosophically he thinks it's just ridiculous to pay, quasi quoting him here, pay utilities for something they're already doing. On the other side of the equation, Senator Sinema is very interested in all of the potential energy pay fors here, from the CEP to a carbon tax to you name it. Senator Manchin has made clear that he is copacetic with an increase in or a final corporate rate to pay for the package that would be in about the range of 25%. And Senator Sinema has really questioned whether a corporate rate increase makes sense from the current 21% and whether it would be anti-competitive for U.S. businesses. So while a lot of folks have been critical about sort of the leadership being able to get together a deal here, it definitely feels like you are, you know, trying to pull people together in a way where they are not really operating, certainly on the same infield right now, even if they're in the same stadium, and that we really are at the end of the beginning, not the beginning of the end, in order to get there. So my guess is that October 31st will come and go, that we're probably realistically at best talking between Veterans Day and Thanksgiving. And I think there's a fairly reasonable chance, 50-50 chance, that you could go into Q1 of 2022 before this all gets wrapped up. And as people have noted, we got the Affordable Care Act done in, you know, end of Q1, early Q2 of, you know, 2010. So in that sense, we are ahead of schedule. These big things, and this is a very big thing, this will end up being much larger between reconciliation and the infrastructure bill, much larger than the Affordable Care Act in terms of federal expenditures. You know, we are definitely, I think, taking the right amount of time for serious legislation.
Okay. Do you think that the reconciliation bill is more important to the Biden administration than the infrastructure? And if so, what things in there do you think the Biden administration really needs or wants to see as it goes from $3 trillion plus? If it goes down to $1.5 trillion, will they still get things that they need, whether it's income tax credits or whatever it may be? What are your thoughts on that?
Good question. You know, we are at a point in this country where the average American questions almost every institution, and the lack of trust for institutions, from the church to the police to, you know, government to you name it, is very significant now. So approval ratings for all major institutions in our country are way down. I don't think the president stated this as part of his campaign, but I think implicit in what he's trying to do is to restore faith in government. And that is a very high threshold to try to achieve. And to his credit, he's got a pretty bold vision for trying to do it. There's no question that the reconciliation package is more important to that than the infrastructure package. The infrastructure package, I think most people view as, if you can't do that, get off the field. That is pretty basic block and tackling. And that may be one of the reasons why it was able to get bipartisan appeal and the number of votes it got in the Senate. The reconciliation package, as opposed to the infrastructure package, needs to be a collection of programs funded at the end of the day that are going to impact the lives of average Americans in ways that they can feel. And if you're a House Democrat, hopefully feel in the next year. But whether it's, you know, free community college or pre-K for every child or drug pricing controls or, you know, the nuts and bolts of programs that we're talking about funding. And I would include climate in there, but I would just warn everybody that while everybody supports climate, you know, funding and actions in this bill, they do not impact the average American in kind of the same way that the social programs do. So success here at the end of the day for the administration is not just getting the bill done, but having the average American understand what the bill does for them. And that's where sort of the Build Back Better moniker has to change. It's this broad title. They don't understand what it means. The only thing they know about this package right now is that it costs $3.5 trillion. They don't know what it's going to do for them. And I'm not therefore advocating that they cut back the number of programs, but I think every program included needs to be sort of tested, if you will, from the perspective of, is the average citizen, the average voter, going to look at this and say, this benefits me? And that's very different from the way we look at legislation on a regular basis. And, you know, I think we can get there with this bill, but again, it's going to take some time to winnow that down and create that focus and then create messaging that will deliver the understanding to the average person.
And Rich, do you hear, you know, I know we're in the middle of a, hopefully maybe coming out of a pandemic and the crisis and all that, but there's a lot of smart people in Washington thinking about the long term of the delta between what the government's spending and what they're bringing in for revenue and how quickly, as you mentioned earlier, you know, the past, I guess maybe three presidents or administrations and really Congress along with them have added to the national debt where it's really skyrocketed. When people think about it and talk about it, what is the thinking in Washington on that and how will it be addressed to try to close that delta, or do we really just have to wait till we come out of the crisis?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, you're going to raise a lot more revenue if something like the revenue package proposed for reconciliation comes out the back end at the end of the day and create more equity in the tax system. So I think you do achieve some of that in this package, but the reality of the situation is we've spent, for good reason, a lot of money during the pandemic. And, you know, I think have created constructs like child tax credit and things like that that are really having major impacts, lifting 50% of kids out of poverty. And so at this point, you do have to balance it, you know, the deficit reduction with what was the need. And I think the balance right now tips towards that need. I do think over time, people will come back to a sense of, you know, we need to be serious about deficit reduction. And, you know, that's going to impact opportunity going forward for maintaining and, you know, growing federal programs in this space, which is why this is such a particular window in time to get this kind of package done. But yeah, I mean, I think Janet Yellen would tell you that she looks at things like, you know, the global tax discussion as a way to deal with that. If we can have a 15% minimum global tax, and there are, you know, a lot of companies willing to work on that and make it rational so that they can work with it, you're avoiding, you know, at that point, some of the revenue drain that has happened over the last 10 to 15 years in terms of corporate payments to the U.S. Treasury.
Yeah, and it will be even, and if interest rates have to be, you know, ratcheted up a little bit, that will even make it more difficult. All right. Well, enough of the of mechanics of the Hill. How are things at Holland and Knight? And how are you all finding the continuing battle of lobbying during a time of COVID? And things are beginning to open up, so it must be getting a little easier.
Yeah. I mean, I think we probably end up going, quote unquote, going back to the office in January at this point. I think a lot of people are eager to do that. We are a very social firm and group of people. We have a 90-person policy group, and, you know, on the back of a 1,600-lawyer law firm. So we definitely miss the collaboration and the team building that goes on when we're in the office together. I do think that is somewhat straining at this point. So for all the sort of effectiveness people were surprised to find in working remotely, you know, for say the first year, I think that is now being offset by, you know, not being able to see my colleagues and not being able to have less formal conversations. We work as a group very much in small teams with clients. And so there's a lot of collaboration there, and not only with the client team, but also, you know, with the client themselves. And to try and capture that over the phone or capture that on Zoom is not the same thing. So I think everybody is kind of looking forward to, you know, getting back at it and having personal interaction in the office. Even if we're still in the space of wearing masks, I think almost everybody on our team, I think everybody on our team has been vaccinated. And I would say on a daily basis now, out of the 60 in the DC office on our floor, I would say we're between 10 to 15 in the office every day. So we're getting back to, I wouldn't say normal, but, you know, sort of pre-normal.
So 90 people. How many people did you have when you took over the Holland & Knight shop?
Oh.
Five?
That was 1999. I'm going to guess it was between 5 and 10. Yeah.
That's incredible. And I have to say that whenever you talk to anybody in your practice, they really like working there and they really like working with you. So it is a constant theme that I hear when we talk to people at Holland & Knight.
Well, it is definitely, you know, it's a little bit like an ant farm. I will go back to...
I love these analogies. These are great. Grateful Dead. What was the other one? Thelma and Louise.
Yep.
Now an ant farm.
Strong team orientation, a lot of collaboration. I happen to be, you know, the queen or whatever the big ant is that sits in the middle and gets credit for crap, but... The reality is it's everything else going on around me that is the work of the day. We have collectively, collaboratively built a platform that's a lot of fun, and we don't take ourselves too seriously. And whenever you see somebody not doing that, they tend to get themselves in trouble. So I'm glad we have what we have. I'm glad collaboratively and collectively we've been able to build it together. And I think we're all very lucky to, you know, be in a job where you can get up in the morning and look forward to going to work.
All right. One last question. Let's give a plug to your Eyes on Washington series. Tell our listeners about that so they can check it out.
That is our knowledge platform at Holland & Knight PP&R, our public policy and regulation group. So we have everything from a weekly newsletter that goes out to our social media channels on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, to our podcast that runs, I would say, about weekly with different issues, substantive issues. And those range from everything in the federal space to our attorney general folks, Stephen Cobb and Jim Schultz on the DNR side for our AG's practice, to our state lobbyists out there plowing away in the fields and state capitals. So it's a good space to kind of get a sense of what are the substantive issues of the day that folks are focusing on and clients care about.
Well, we will include a link to it in the show notes so that people can check it out. Rich, thank you for coming on. It was great to chat with you again. And for our listeners out there, remember you can check us out on social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. You can also sign up for our email. It comes out on Mondays. You can do that at thepoliticallife.net. We hope you all have a great week, and we will see you next Monday.